What's up, everybody? Welcome to this week's Market Forces segment of the Hidden Forces podcast with me, Dimitri Kafinas. Today, I speak with Charlie Grant, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where he covers U.S. healthcare and industrial companies, including the electric car company Tesla, which he has been writing critically on since 2015. In his previous life, Charlie was a reporter at Grant's Interest Rate Observer and is a CFA charter holder. Charlie, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, how'd you like my little intro there of you?
It was smooth. It was smooth.
You didn't give me much else to work with, Matt.
Yeah, well, you know, we have tight word counts at the Journal, so I keep my bio in similarly tight
fashion. You know, that article you guys wrote that we're going to get into, well, we're going to get into the SolarCity acquisition, but I could totally tell. It was a few people. It was you and two other writers on that total, right?
That's right, yeah.
But I could tell that one of the comments about flattering the balance sheet, that totally came from you.
That might be a Grant family.
Exactly,
yes.
Yeah. So we're big fans of Grant's Interest Rate Observer here. And that conference is coming up now, too, next week, actually, I think. The week after. So, yeah, Charlie, I'm very excited to have you on. I've known you now since 2011 or
12, something like that.
Yeah. 11 or 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the first time you're on the show, but you've become a prolific tweeter and you've amassed quite a following.
Shout out to Jack Dorsey. Yeah. You made an addictive platform.
And you've been writing about Tesla for at least since 2015. And I've just caught wind of it just from Twitter. And I know you've been doing a lot of great work on it. And it's something that I haven't had an opportunity to cover on this show because of all the other stuff we cover. But given sort of what's been going on in the news lately and the fact that I think Tesla is sort of at the intersection of a lot of these forces that we cover, the sort of growing income wealth gap, the availability of cheap financing, the allure of technology and the way that it sort of captures the dreams and aspirations of this sort of bull market, and just Elon Musk's role as a sort of an icon for this bull market. I think it's a really interesting story. I want, you know, for my sake and for our audience's sake. Oh, and before I even say that, I got to say, I'm starting to do this now because I'm doing more finance shows. This is not financial advice. Don't sue me. That's what I said when I had Brian Kelly on.
Yeah, what's the official? This is definitely not financial advice.
What's the official way you do that? It's not.
That's clear enough. Yes. No, I prefer plain English to boilerplate legal language, not investment advice.
All right. So I have a bunch of quotes here that are really cool, but I'm going to pull up a couple of yours before we start. One of them is, it's high time. This is from October 7th. It's high time for Tesla and Wall Street to acknowledge reality. These are both from you. And my favorite is, CEO Elon Musk is a visionary, but there's a fine line between setting aggressive goals and misleading shareholders. Very direct, Charlie. So this is what I want to talk about, because you're not the only one that's been talking about this. Tesla's been sort of, controversy has surrounded this company since day one. I mean, one way or another. But there's sort of been an ebb and flow of it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have really hit a critical state recently. So maybe you can give us a sort of a timeline history of Tesla. I think the company was founded or began operations in 2003. It went public in 2010, shortly after it produced its first car.
The Roadster, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about sort of this company's history and how we got here.
Right. You know, Elon Musk started, he published his grand master plan on the internet. And the idea was to build luxury electric cars for a select, you know, few ultra high-end product, make some profits off that, reinvest those profits into building a mainstream electric car, which is what you'll know now as the Model 3. And that would launch, you know, a new era of electrification and some of the things that come with that, you know, self-driving capabilities, that sort of thing. Ride sharing, you know, a lot of what Silicon Valley envisions for the automotive future. And in some ways, he's accomplished almost all of those goals. The Model S, you know, started being built en masse in, you know, 2013 or so. Tesla narrowly averted bankruptcy. People saw this great car. It's a great car. I want to be clear about that.
Have you ever driven one?
No, but I've ridden in it. And, you know, I mean, look.
It's amazing.
On a reporter's salary, a high-end Tesla is not really an option in this business. But, you know, it's a great car. The product, the allure of the product certainly has helped propel the rise of the business. But what Tesla has, in many ways, satisfied what its visionaries and its early, you know, disciples, if you will, and they are disciples, in mind. But where the master plan deviated from reality was that Tesla was building these cars not from reinvesting their own profits. They've never made any meaningful profit, but from the continuous generosity of the capital markets. They've been regular raisers of equity. They've raised significant debt in recent years, convertible bonds eventually turning into pure fixed rate instruments. And Wall Street's been all too happy to fund this, but the profits never really materialized. And it has created the situation where Tesla, you alluded to all this controversy, where they make these great products and they get these fans that are truly passionate about them. I have the emails to prove it.
You get a lot of emails.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have fans. Readers have a right to chime in with their feedback, and they give it to me.
Well, have you ever gotten any interesting bull arguments for Tesla?
Sure. We can get to those in a minute, but this is where the flashpoint is, because the bears, like myself, will say, well, you've never made a business that can stand on its own. And capital markets access comes and goes. And where Tesla has had this high stock price and bigger valuations than Ford and GM and that sort of thing, but they've still been really living hand to mouth on a year-to-year basis. And sooner or later, that catches up with you.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you think it's caught up to them now at this point?
I think that's part of the reason why we've seen the stock go down so much in the past month or so.
So with the Roadster, were they profitable? Did they have gross profits at that time?
There were spot periods, like in 2013, where they made a narrow gap profit.
Hmm. When did they release the Model S?
Around then, early to mid part of this decade, so 2012, 2013.
There was a time with the Model S, a window where I think sentiment generally improved tremendously on the company, right?
Yes, because they had averted bankruptcy and the car was here. And people could see how cool this thing was. And they were not wrong about that. I want to give credit where it's due. And it was heavily shorted at the time, as it all has been.
When was this?
Back in around 2013.
2013.
And the stock went from somewhere around $20 to $200 in a year. It just rocketed. And there have been bumps in the road here and there since then. But more or less, it's been a smooth ride higher. At least if you just look at things from a stock market perspective. If you look a little deeper, things start to get a little more iffy for this business.
Well, it seems like you don't have to look very deep to see that.
At this point, no, but yeah.
I have not engaged really deeply with Tesla or the car industry more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did pretty much beyond just the general sort of hearsay that I've gotten over the last few years was in the last 2 days, after I spoke to you and I said, listen, Charlie, I want you to come on, let's talk about this. And I spent the last 2 days kind of going through the financials, checking some stuff out. And it looks pretty scary. And it looks pretty obviously scary.
I think so, yeah.
So I also did some, in my research, I saw some interesting things that Jim Chanos said. Specifically, the one thing that really stuck out to me was that he had put together a spreadsheet with all the executive departures of the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he compared the company to Enron. And of course, mm-hmm. Jim Chanos famously shorted Enron in the early 2000s. For him, he talks about what he calls the dark turn, which was the acquisition of SolarCity
mm-hmm.
by Tesla in 2016, I
yes.
believe. Where does that sort of sit in your view in terms of the trajectory of this company? Was that really a fateful turn? Was it more something that illuminated what was already company practice, sort of practiced by Elon Musk, or did it really embolden him to begin to act in a way that breaks perhaps with sort of his fiduciary duty?
Well, so I think that a lot of the problems we are seeing today with the current stock price slide and Tesla's signature bond issue trading in the mid-80s on the dollar, well below par, sign of significant financial stress, I would say the SolarCity acquisition is a huge part of that. The stock market, of course, loved it at the time because SolarCity was experiencing significant financial stress.
Talk to the audience, for those who don't know, tell them what SolarCity
sure
is.
Thing.
Give them a backstory on this.
Sure. So SolarCity was another Elon Musk project. He wasn't CEO, but he was chairman of the company and its largest shareholder. And that's the rooftop solar panel clean energy business, which in theory doesn't really have much to do with manufacturing an automobile. So SolarCity was another high-flying stock, but solar accounting is very complicated. The technology is changing rapidly. Solar prices, the economics of installing solar on a roof you know, sort of like an electric car, but not really. We're not are interesting, and you'll get adopters, but the industry is still young and hasn't figured out a way to make the economics work. That's a common thread here.
The solar industry.
Solar industry. And also true for the auto, but I'm talking about solar now. We can talk about the auto issues.
Those are two different paths too, right, in solar. One is this the large solar fields, like the kind of stuff we see in like Arizona.
Sure.
Versus the idea of having each individual home plated with solar.
Yes, yes. And I'm talking about the rooftop business specifically being problematic here. So Solar City, you are securitizing these assets. So your balance sheet, you know, automatically becomes very heavy with debt. And SolarCity's stock price was falling. The bonds were trading at distressed levels. And it really looked like the company might not survive.
Did this start in 2015?
2015 was when the problems started to appear. 2016, they got acute. And in June 2016, Tesla announced that it was buying SolarCity. And Elon Musk is the largest shareholder of both companies and the chairman of both companies. And these two businesses don't really have much to do with each other.
So let's talk about a second. So what percentage of SolarCity did Elon Musk own?
Not sure off the top of my head, but significant chunk, double-digit ownership. I think in the 20s, pretty close to Tesla, which is, you know, he owns a little more than a fifth of Tesla and a similar percentage of SolarCity. Yeah. So not the majority and owner, but enough to make something happen, especially when you're also chairman of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so this deal seemed, you know, from us, you know, we were in complete shock. I mean, this is kind of, shall we say, not in accordance with traditional corporate governance practices to do this sort of thing. But at the deal closed, SolarCity seemed to be saved because they had the Tesla's access to the capital markets, which made some people think that these debt problems might be resolved. And Tesla's share price took off right after the acquisition again. It had fallen down to, you know, the high $100 range, 180, something like that. And at its peak last summer, the stock reached into, you know, north of $380 a share.
Well, didn't its market cap surpass GM's?
Yes. Yes.
Which is remarkable when you look at the number of cars it's manufacturing versus the number of cars that GM's manufacturing. To interrupt here, to interject perhaps is a better way to put it. We did a show over the summer with Hubert Horan, the transportation analyst on Uber.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, there are some similarities for me between Uber and Tesla, specifically in terms of the sort of secret sauce hope or expectation that investors have around that justify the valuation. The idea that with in the case of Uber, that the application and the routing system would allow the company to overcome the losses to economies of scale generated by the traditional taxi limo industry. And similarly with Tesla, the idea that they would be able to have a market cap larger than GM, which produces however many millions of cars.
Millions,
yeah. Yeah, like 11 million or something. Or if that's VW, I have this number here, VW does that. GM is just under 10 million cars. And I guess the idea of that is that they have some kind of really incredible head start on the future, which is electric vehicles and technology.
Exactly. So the idea is a decade from now, we'll all be driving Teslas, we'll all be using Uber. You know, in both cases, what makes these companies so disruptive to the traditional incumbent players is that investors are willing to fund losses at absurd levels. Tesla at one point was losing about $20,000 on a GAAP net income basis per car sold. And, you know, GM and Ford's shareholder base just simply won't tolerate that sort of thing. And that gives it that makes it for a significant disadvantage, though, for management teams when you chart your strategy. So, you know, that's to your point at the top of this broadcast about, you know, macroeconomic low interest rates, easy credit. There's a very common thread between Tesla and Uber and a lot of these other so-called disruptors that you see in the market, that the willingness to fund losses is something you only see when money is easy. Mm-hmm. And you can just tap the markets again and again and again. And that becomes the zeitgeist and the thought process of investors. And that can take you very far. But if you don't build a sustainable business, then you have a very high diving board that you're at risk on.
So Tesla was founded in 2003. It sold its first car in 2010. That was shortly after the market peaked at over $140 a barrel, right?
Oil.
There were oil. There were expectations that we would see $200 a barrel. I mean, certainly no one expected that we would, not no one, I'm sure there were people that did, but many people were caught flat-footed by the fracking sort of revolution. Mm-hmm. And
caught me off guard.
Yeah, it caught me off guard as well. And so how much of a role do you think that has played in sort of acting as a headwind for Tesla in its attempt to sort of break through as a startup car manufacturer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one reason electric cars are still niches. I mean, GM, I think Bloomberg reported a year ago or so that GM's electric car, the Chevy Bolt, which is not particularly
sell. That was Lutz's project, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. No, or that was, I mean, he's been gone a while, but yeah, I mean, the electrification, you know, that car is celebrated, but they're losing something like $9,000 on every one they sell. And so they can't build that many of them. And
do they not get subsidies on those?
They do, but the economics still don't work. I mean, the buyer gets a subsidy.
And that's a particularly American phenomenon, right? Because in Europe, I assume that these cars are more popular.
They are, yes. And also because gas, you know, there are draconian gas taxes there, yeah, and that sort of thing. Here in America, the opportunity cost to owning a gas guzzler is much lower. And people want big Ford F-150, you know. Tesla is very popular on the coasts and, you know, in New York and San Francisco and those places. But, you know, there's a great middle in this country, and SUVs, pickup trucks, that sort of thing are still the name of the game. And when you have, you know, access to cheap gasoline, the opportunity cost benefit of driving electric is kind of thin.
Yeah.
So that's been an issue holding back electrification more generally. That's not really a specific Tesla issue beyond the fact that they're all electric cars. But, you know, that's an issue that GM and other guys trying to break into the EV market in the U.S. face.
So I mentioned subsidies there. Subsidies have played a huge role in Tesla's growth.
Mm-hmm. It's part of the controversy, too.
Okay. Yeah. Well, talk to me a little bit about that. So, I mean, we talked about the debt. That's going to keep coming in and out. I do want to talk about sort of the economics of these cars, but let's talk a little bit about the subsidies, and maybe you can tie that into what the cost is of building a Roadster. Well, they don't have the Roadster anymore. They have a new supposed Roadster that's going to come
right,
at some point.
Yes.
But the Model S, the Model 3, the cost of actually creating one of these vehicles, how much they can bring in theoretically sort of with them, or they are bringing in, and, you know, how that all ties in with the subsidies.
Well, yeah, so there's a few different ways these subsidies work, and there's not one coherent, you know, policy here we're going on, but there's the federal tax credit for an EV buyer. You get up to $7,500 for a qualifying electric car as a tax rebate, and that applies for the first 200,000 cars that in the U.S. that a manufacturer sells, a brand. So mm-hmm. Tesla, all of GM would fall under that umbrella. No one's hit that number yet, but people think that this year sometime Tesla will cross it.
Which is why they're going to lose the subsidy.
They wouldn't lose it right away under current law. It would be, you have like a 6-month grace period once you sell the 200,000th car, and then it tapers gradually. So mm-hmm. you probably take another year or so before it went away altogether. But that's the buyer tax subsidy. In California, there's state-level credits for EV buyers as well that can also lower the consumer's bill. And the manufacturer, because of like zero emissions laws, so if you make a polluting car, you've got to make a clean one. Mm. And so a lot of manufacturers will sell what are known as compliance cars to comply with the regulations, but not necessarily a product that they're going to be aggressive or just not featuring,
right,
you know, in terms of a bottom line, how they plan to make money in the auto business. So you earn what are called credits, you know, so zero emission credits, and you can satisfy your emissions requirements either by building a clean car or by buying the credits from someone else. So Tesla, since they only make electric cars, zero emissions,
they have
those credits they can sell. And that's been an important revenue source.
That's interesting.
Because that's very high margin. You know, it's a small part of their overall revenue, but the margins on that are 100%, essentially.
Right.
And so that's certainly helping, you know, keep the finances afloat somewhat. And then there's also non-economic incentives. Like, if you've ever driven in California, you know, if you have an electric car, you can use the HOV lane, even mm-hmm. if you're by yourself.
That's also true here as well.
Yeah, and I mean, but in particular, in California that seems, I have to confess, that's something I'd be willing to pay for if I lived there. You know, it's not economics, it's not a pure financial subsidy, but it matters when you're considering whether to buy one. You know, and then so this company becomes political because some, you know, conservatives don't really like the idea of tax subsidies. And so, you know, there's that angle of the controversy with Tesla. And
but let's say just in terms of like if I'm looking at the financials of this company, right?
Yeah.
And I'm taking into account the subsidies and I'm taking this all of this stuff into account as I'm looking at what the costs are and what the revenue prospects are and what the prospects are for profitability for this company. Like realistically, when you look at the financials here, right? Mm-hmm. What is the path to profitability for this company?
I don't see one.
You don't see one?
No.
At all?
No.
So why is that not reflected in the stock price? What do you account for?
It started to. See, I differ with the broader market on
sure.
this.
Sure. Well, you differed for a while about it.
Yes. And I've been wrong. There's a term for that. But I don't want to shy away from that and pretend. You know, some of my predictions have been premature.
I told
it runs in the family. But
I actually, the audience may not know this, but your father is Jim Grant, who had been on the program, and he's made a comment before here that I really liked, which actually Josh Wolf also repeated on his own separately. Which is, but your dad had said, Jim had said that we at Grants like to think that we like to be right later.
Yes.
And I told you I'd spoken with Mark Spiegel a couple days ago, and he's going to be on the program next Monday to talk about this exact same thing. And he's been short the company for like 4 years or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can be wrong for a long time before you're right.
Yes, absolutely. That's the way markets work.
But to bring it back to that, which is that the market, and this kind of feeds back to the bull story that Tesla, looking back, it may end up being sort of one of the iconic companies of the bull market.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not uncharacteristic, of course, you have manias in stock prices. But I am curious, how does the market rationalize the price? And what are some of the other factors? For example, like there has been a willingness by different funds to invest in Tesla. What is the rationale for the price, and what is the rationale for the price currently?
Well, the bull argument is still that, you know, this company is going to dominate the future of the auto industry 10, 20 years out. And bulls, you know, who have more sophisticated arguments around this than others, but, you know, the gist of it is essentially, I'm willing to endure the short term, you know, ups and downs of manufacturing. Eventually they'll figure out how to mass produce a car like all the GMs and Fords, but they'll just have much nicer products that everyone will want. And eventually they'll gradually push these other guys to the sidelines of the auto business. And, you know, 10, 20 years out, Tesla will have 40, 50% market share. I mean,
But let's talk about that, because I've tried to follow those bull arguments. Mm-hmm. And what I was hoping or expecting to find was that there would be some interesting proprietary piece of technology that Tesla's been developing, for example, in autonomous driving. To my surprise, from what I understand, they don't have a single patent on autonomous driving. Which is surprising for me, considering that they're a technology company located in Silicon Valley and that this is supposed to be the future. And so much of what I think defines them in the popular mind is that they're technology company,
right?
Technology car,
right? That's a load of hooey. They're a car company,
right? So they're an upstart car company.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, and I'm putting you on the spot here to give someone else's argument, but I'm just trying to understand what the coherent argument that the bulls are making is. How could you get there if you needed to get there, if you wanted to make the case for them?
Well, the part of it is that only a small percentage of Americans have tried this car, and the idea is once you try this, you'll never want to drive anything else.
It is a pretty awesome experience.
Yeah.
But the question is that the experience of driving a fast electric car,
right,
or is it the experience of driving a Tesla?
Right, right.
And there, I think, what is it, Audi, BMW, Porsche, Mercedes, these companies are all going to be coming out with fully electric vehicles.
And that's a huge part of why I think that Tesla's hard times are just only starting to begin here, is to what you just said. The competition has been, Tesla had a huge head start. They were more serious about this front than any other company. You know, legacy automakers were slow to realize how popular electric would be, how in demand this would be on Wall Street, that sort of thing. And so that gave Tesla a huge leg up. And this is all credit to Elon Musk, that he has inspired, you know, the rest of the industry to get serious about this. But now you have these experienced car makers. Porsche's no joke in terms of making a nice car, right?
It's a gorgeous car.
Yeah. Then it's going to be all electric, you know, I'm not sure any one of these individual brands how big of a seller they're going to be. But, you know, Jaguar unveiled their new SUV to compete with Tesla's SUV.
But I've seen some of these have prices below the Model S.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, it's not, and these are beautiful cars. I mean,
exactly.
If you look at them, they're very attractive.
Exactly. Like, I mean, it's one thing to say a Chevy Volt can't compete with a Tesla. I agree with that. That's factual.
And that was the paradigm before Tesla. That's where Tesla innovated, right?
Right.
I mean, so Elon Musk supposedly was traveling around Silicon Valley going to garages and seeing people would have a Porsche parked next to a Toyota hybrid.
Yeah.
And he said, essentially, they want an electric vehicle, but they also have the money to spend for a...
Yes. And that was a completely valid market segment that they've gone after. I think Tesla made a mistake, though, in trying to become a mainstream auto manufacturer.
Which the Model 3.
Right.
Which is where
the
real disaster has struck, right?
Right. And there would, a niche auto player, you can make a profit and be a standalone business. You might not get much equity value for that, though. So, I mean, I always thought Tesla would do fine if they stuck to making, you know, basically custom ultra high end, you know, suite rides for a very wealthy select population, which is how they got started. You know, there's a lot of rich people in Silicon Valley. You can make that kind of business work and keep the scale small enough where you can manage it. But Elon promised 1 million cars on the road by 2020 back in 2016 when they were putting out, you know, 50,000 in a year.
And they still haven't sold 200,000, as you said.
In the U.S. They've sold more than 200,000 worldwide. But, like, they're talking about, you know, I mean, an exponential ramp in production fast. And you have to know how to do this because the auto business, frankly, is not a good business. It's very hard. It's capital intensive. You get your parts delivered up front. You know, it takes up a serious amount of working capital. It's economically sensitive. Luxury car sales get hammered in every recession. It's been a long time since we've had one, but that, I mean, you just don't sell high-end cars in that environment.
The manufacturing process also changed tremendously. Forget the automation component, right? Which I think there's something really enamoring about Tesla building all their cars here domestically and having sort of, you know, their operations here. From what I understand, all their plants are here, correct?
Yes.
But the thing that I've discovered in delving into this a bit is just how much the car industry has changed over the last couple of decades, and the role of suppliers in this process, and that they actually have much higher price to earnings ratios for their stocks than the OEMs. That's a huge issue too, right? Because that's networks and business development and relationships.
Yeah, just look at how the auto stocks have done in this roaring bull market over the last 8 years. You know, the Volkswagens of the world, it's been great conditions to sell cars. Easy credit has helped. You know, auto sales in the U.S. were at record-breaking paces year after year after year. And the market gave GM 6-7 times earnings on their multiple. And Ford, the same thing. And Toyota, maybe 8 or 9, but nothing too different. And I think that's basically right. I think the market has it right with that. You know, this is a very hard business, and a lot of things go wrong, sometimes beyond your control. And its profits are minimal, and everything has to go just right to make things work. In the world's most efficient plants, something like a few minutes of downtime unscheduled in a year can make the whole operation unprofitable. Like, everything needs to be just so. And you can't just decide you're going to learn how to do that. You know, there's one of the reasons why we haven't really had a meaningful auto startup in the last, you know, 50 years that has lasted.
And this also kind of brings back something else you said, which is that the public has operated, I think, and investors have operated under the assumption that the skills that Tesla is acquiring and the brand it's building that's purely electric are going to outweigh the legacy knowledge that comes from being a car manufacturer. But what I've discovered in my reading and what you're saying, it sounds like, is that actually what's far more important still is all the other stuff and not, let's say, the battery, which has been, like, for example, some big thing.
It's much more than just design.
Exactly. That, in fact, all the know-how that comes with building a car is still vastly more important than any other part of this business.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just a matter of, you know, intelligence or anything like this. You know, Elon Musk can land a rocket ship on a barge. And you know what? I can't do that.
And that's a big part of this also.
Hey, have you landed a rocket on a barge? And you know what? I say, you got me there. I have not. So, you know, it's not like he's not a smart guy or something. But this is specialized knowledge that you can't just substitute for with something else. And that is what the Bulls have missed here.
Well, that's also what's so cool about this story. You know, separate, like putting aside all the financial stuff, you know what I mean? Like putting aside all the, like the meat and potatoes. It's the fact that Elon Musk captures the wildest aspirations of this bull market. And also, I think this particular iteration of a bull market at this particular point in our evolution, technology and the innovations that are happening in technology, the public is becoming increasingly aware of things that would otherwise seem to be extremely obtuse subjects, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, advances in healthcare and biotechnology, you know, synthetic biology, all these things. And I think, and the fact that this guy has a space company, like you said, he is launching rockets into space, launching his car into space, by the way, which I think is...
That was, might have been a waste of money, but...
But that's also really fascinating, right? So that he launched a roadster into space. I want to ask you something, and I don't mean this, you know, I'll put it in a non sort of controversial way. You know, there are people like Lutz, for example, Bob Lutz of the former vice chair of GM, right?
Yep.
Who has called, I think it's him or maybe it was someone else, he's called it a Ponzi scheme. Some people have called it a Ponzi scheme. I thought that was kind of weird for someone to call Tesla a Ponzi scheme. But when I looked into it a little deeper, let's say the bear case, if you were to make a bear case, it's not a traditional Ponzi scheme, but you could say that one of the features of Tesla, which is so unique, is that Elon manages to diffuse anxieties or concerns about, let's say, a potentially failing business or a potentially failing project by not creating a new business, but creating sort of the prospect of a new business, whether it is high-speed tunnels, whether it's semi-trucks, whether it is, he even talked about some kind of electric plane, like, you know, all this stuff.
The Hyperloop, New York to Washington in 20 minutes.
And yeah, he just comes up with this. It's
which
pretty
sounds nice, but color me skeptical on that one.
But it's a fascinating thing, though, right? Because, you know, just to bring it back to this, to get away from the meat and potatoes and just on this sort of aspirational quality, it's really astounding how far, regardless of what the fate of Tesla is or if people agree with you or don't agree with you, there, no one can deny that Elon is a tremendous showman, and he's managed to use that to great effect.
Absolutely.
And, you know, in covering him and in covering the story, have you ever found anyone like that? I must say, when I thought about it, I certainly didn't think that Steve Jobs qualified. I thought you'd have to go to Walt Disney or P.T. Barnum. I couldn't think of anyone comparable within the last sort of boom.
Yeah, well, just look at the Gallup polls of most popular Americans. Okay, Elon Musk is from South Africa, but, you know, he was included in this poll. And he was in the top five. I saw this. This came out maybe a few months ago. And Elon was one of the, you know, most popular Americans. And I got to tell you, there were no other business CEOs anywhere close on that list. It's kind of crazy how people truly idolize him in a way that's unique. I mean, no other company has that. And that has been part of the reason why Tesla has reached such heights. And I also think that is part of the reason that they're getting into trouble now.
Did you see the interview that, what's his name, one of the writers for Interstellar did with Elon at South by Southwest?
I read about it. I didn't.
You had to really
that.
Watch it. But like, it's not different than a lot of other ones. But it was really funny because this guy's sitting there asking him, you know, these really esoteric questions about existential risks to humanity, around things that I talk about on the show, interesting things about, you know, the problem with designing a utility function for AI and whatever, like global warming, whatever it is, like these existential risks. And Elon's sitting there with his flight jacket, right?
Mm-hmm.
Looks like he just got off of a spaceship. And that's it. And he's giving these answers. But the reality is he's also the CEO of these different companies.
Mm-hmm. And he's not at the auto plant while this is going on.
Right.
He's at South by Southwest. He's at the Oscars. He's in Australia with Amber Heard. And, like, you know, if you're running a private company, then you should do it your way. But, you know, public companies, I think you should be really sure there are no problems going on in your own backyard when you're making appearances like that. And as we've seen in the last few weeks, definitely not all is well at Tesla.
And, you know, the thing is, I totally agree with that. And it's just, again, for me personally, I want a guy like Elon to succeed. I love what he's done with space travel. Mm-hmm. I love the audacity. But at the end of the day, you know, you can only get so many free passes.
That's
and
right.
What it seems like to me is that where we're at with Tesla and why I wanted to bring you in here and talk about it today, given what's been happening most recently, is that it feels like, unlike the other times, it feels like this time something is really breaking.
Yeah.
And it's breaking also because we may be at a point where the tide is coming in.
Well, so that's...
Or going out, as
so,
they say.
So we got off a bit of a tangent there from the SolarCity acquisition, but I want to come back to that. That Tesla, what they always had before... was a pretty clean balance sheet. So the profits looked dopey. You know, they were never going to make any money. And I always thought, well, the stock could go down a lot, but there wasn't much debt on the balance sheet. You could always issue equity and refigure things out. You know, those companies could definitely experience sharp declines, but as long as you keep your debt burden, you know, to a dull roar, you can survive a lot of things. But what happened with SolarCity when Tesla assumed that their debt went from maybe $2 billion, most of which was convertible bonds, so they didn't even necessarily owe the principal back. Now it's more like $10 billion. And that is a really scary thing if your production, if you keep losing money the way you always have. And so we've seen that. Tesla issued a $1.7 billion bond last August to help finance the Model 3. And that bond got downgraded by Moody's after one interest payment. And that bond is trading at 86, 87 cents on the dollar, less than a year after being issued.
No, super
scary. They've spent all the proceeds already, you know, on their cash burn. And now what? So that's, you know, really alarming because they still don't make a profit. We don't have first quarter numbers, but I strongly suspect we'll see more sharp losses. And when you have this debt, it means the clock is ticking. You can't just say Elon's going to figure it out one day. He needs to figure it out
right
now. And
it's ticking in a rising interest rate environment and also uncertainty of the time domain, which is we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what's going to happen to liquidity.
That's right. That's right. And they've put themselves in this position where even if they clean up their manufacturing problems, you know, handle this recall that was announced on Thursday...
123,000 Model S's, right?
Yep. And that's, you know, the supplier is going to pay for the replacement parts, but it's still going to cost Tesla money. You know, labor is not free. That is, even if they figure those things out, like you mentioned, rising rates, like some things that are, they've exposed themselves to factors that are not even, you know, within their control here. And living at the pleasure of the capital markets, well, it's been a long time since this happened, but capital markets do close up, sometimes without warning. And, I mean, if that happens, this company is toast.
How does this end?
How does this end?
How have you... Look, you're not an oracle, but how...
I'm really not. Let's make that clear to the audience.
None of us are. But I'm sure you've imagined ways in which it might end. What are some of those that you've envisioned?
Well, I think they can hang on for a while. I mean, the stock has been going down sharply for a few weeks now. We've seen that before and had sharp rebounds. Basically, Moody's said when they downgraded that debt last week that they need to raise $2 billion in the near term. And they could do that in the equity market, possibly. I think the debt market is a non-starter, given the way the last bond situation is going.
You're saying issue more equity.
Yeah. But, you know, now the stock price, that currency is worth a lot less than it was, you know, 6 months ago. And when they were actually in much better shape when the Model 3 was this vision instead of this actual product that's causing significant losses and a lot of production headaches. I mean, so Tesla has overpromised and underdelivered. Elon Musk said in 2016 they were going to build 100,000 Model 3s in the second half of 2017. And they built like 3,000, something like that, 2,000. And he said 100 to 200,000. You can't, in the public markets, even a guy that everyone wants to believe in, like Elon Musk, you can't keep pulling stunts like that. Eventually, people stop believing you. And if people have lost faith in him, it could get very ugly very quickly. I don't think people have totally lost faith in him yet. You know, I think even if he can't raise enough equity, the world is still awash in liquidity. You can go to SoftBank. You can go to Tencent. You know, there are theoretical options out there, but he needs to find a new stream of money and he needs to find it soon. Otherwise, the stock is in serious trouble.
But what's challenging for me is I want to find the way in which a bull would rationalize this. I can't find that case. In other cases where a company is impaired and it's running a very high risk of bankruptcy, I can still, you know, find in sort of the timeline that you're laying out and others have laid out that it can go on for much longer. I can find a sort of way to rationalize that argument. I still haven't come across one that, like you mentioned, faith. I mean, it's not clear to me, based on everything that Elon has said, the company's put out, and the financials, what that case would be. I don't see, it just seems to me that it's so divorced from reality.
Well, you know, one option is, you know, bankruptcy is a dirty word, but when you file for bankruptcy, you can reorganize the company, reset the debt levels, you can, you know, reset the capital structure in a way that makes sense and start fresh. And I think operationally that would be perfect. I certainly would be much less bearish on the outfit if they got a clean start with a new balance sheet. Of course, there's a small little, you know, hold up with that, which is you have to wipe out the current equity holders. And that's obviously not something that can happen without significant angst. And
about finding a buyer? Is that even realistic?
Not at these valuations. I mean, well, maybe not, SpaceX, maybe Elon's.
Not at these valuations. Not right now. Right. But let's say we get to a place where its price becomes attractive. Would a company like, let's say, Apple, which has supposed to be doing some work in autonomous driving and has a proclivity to associate its software with its hardware, would they be interested in possibly buying a company like this in order to compete with, let's say, a Google or an Uber or whatever, some of these other tech companies that are providing the software solution?
Never say never. That could happen. You know, these companies are pretty secretive about their self-driving programs. We know Apple's working on one, but we really don't know much else from the general public. You know, there could be a buyer out there, but here's another reason to wonder whether that could really happen. What if this self-driving thing is kind of just a fad? You know, we saw that Uber accident last week. You know, I think regulators have been, in all these states, self-driving has been, you know, something to welcome, something to be a leader in. But, you know, as you know, regulators can be quite fickle about this sort of thing. So you saw the Arizona governor turn on Uber sharply in a matter of 72 hours. You know, it went from you're welcome in my state to, well, maybe not. And this business is very exciting and valued highly and has captured people's imaginations, but there's no guarantee it's going to pan out.
Well, I actually think that, you know, it's a really good point you bring up. I actually think, generally speaking, we may be on the verge of a rise in regulations, an increase in regulations across a number of industries. We might see it in the cryptocurrency market and see it here as well with autonomous driving vehicles, especially if we have a turn in global equity markets and people lose a lot of money. Mm-hmm. People start asking for the regulations. Yeah. Same thing with autonomous driving vehicles and accidents.
I mean, the Tesla brand is obviously worth something and something meaningful, you know, but that is
at the right price.
Yes. And honestly, that's the sort of thing that if Tesla went bankrupt, they could, you know, you could buy that brand for really not much money and it would be a fantastic deal for a buyer. But that's not a reason to holding on to this
it's not a good case
because
for the
someone's going to buy it. Yeah. You know, the Tesla's plant, the Gigafactory is new, but not a whole lot really goes on there yet. It's not finished. The main plant Tesla got in California was, you know, an old plant from, you know, the 1980s that previous owners had abandoned. They didn't want it. I mean, these assets are not necessarily, there's nothing wrong with them per se, but it's not something that people are going to fall over themselves to have at any price. Mm-hmm. In the industry, Wall Street will always fall over themselves to have the hot toy at any price. But
in general, it just seems that they've bitten off much more than they can chew.
Absolutely.
Charlie, I want to thank you for coming on. And I also want to ask you, and if people want to follow you, you write at the Wall Street Journal. What industries do you cover? How can they find your stuff? And how do they follow you on Twitter, where, as I said, you are a prolific tweeter?
Twitter handle is cgrantwsj. You can find our stuff on the Herd on the Street page that runs in the back of the business and finance section in print and on the market section of the Wall Street Journal online on WSJ.com. And if you want to send me a note about how much you liked my article or much more likely how terrible it was, my
email. What a terrible person you are.
What a terrible person I am. I read it. I don't always get back to you, but I read it. My email is published in the online articles. You can find it there.
All right, man. Charlie, it was great having you on the show, man.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
And that was my Market Forces segment. with Charlie Grant. I want to thank Charlie for being on the program. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nicolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforcespod.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforcespod.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week.